I didn't know anybody that could do more than that. And at that point, I kind of lost interest and didn't really play for a year. I lost my hacky sack in a field. I lost my first one after, I don't know, a year after I owned it or something. I lost it in a field. And then the next summer, I think it's like summer of 79, when my brother saw just a tiny little one-line listing in the list of events that were happening at the KGW Neighbor Fair. So KGW's local radio station, they were putting on this big fair in at Waterfront Park in downtown Portland. And one little line item in there was Hacky Sack Tournament. And so he told me about it. I got my parents to drive me down there. I was 12 at the time. And I had one of our neighbors had found my hacky sack in the field, like right just before that. So I had kind of gotten back into it because it had been lost for, it spent like a year in this field, weathering basically. And then, so I got that back right before this tournament. My brother told me about the tournament. So I went down there and it was a benefit for, muscular dystrophy. So you could pay $5. And that got you 5 attempts, and your best rally in 5 attempts was your official number. And so I entered the under 16 category, and I think I did 3 different entries, so $5 at a time of $15 worth of entries. And my best rally out of those was 456.
Oh wow!
That was good enough to take the division, the under 16.
How old were you?
I was 12. I was almost 13. I was just about to be 13, but I was 12 at the time still. And I saw at that same event, I saw Jack Schoolcraft set what was then the world record for in the over 16 division, the open division, and he did 2,705, and then I also saw it was the first time I'd ever seen anybody play net, and they were playing over an 8-foot high net, and that was cool, but I was definitely much more into focus on this world record, because I had no idea what the world record was, but when I saw it done, and it was very clearly in my sights as like, oh well, okay, that's the number, so I'm gonna have the world record here pretty soon. And I went home right after that tournament, and I didn't basically put that thing down until I had broken the world record in my basement. And I don't remember what I did at home the first time I broke the record. The first time I broke it officially at a tournament was the next summer at the first national championships, what we now consider the first world championships, but at that time it was the Mike Marshall Memorial National Hacky Sack Association Championships, and that was at the Oregon City Territorial Days in Oregon City.
And that was run by World Footbag?
Well, there was no World Footbag yet, so that was run by what was then the only sort of official association, which was the National Hacky Sack Association that Johnny Stahlberger and Ted Huff and Garwin Bruce were kind of the principals of that entity. And I had thought, when I was 12 and going to this tournament, and that, I was calling the National Hacky Sack Association offices each day after that event. And I was thinking I was calling, some high rise office building kind of thing. It was these dudes in this little rundown pink house in Oregon City. you know, living off of Top Ramen probably to, you know, trying to make a go of this, you know, get this new sport launched. But I thought it was kind of a big thing, you know, and so anyway, the next after meeting those guys at the first tournament in Portland, they hadn't seen a 12-year-old that was that good yet at this. Certainly not, you know, some kid off the streets they'd never heard of. And so I was kind of the poster boy for the target audience that they were, you know, trying to promote this game to. And so they, you know, Ted would pick me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and we'd drive all over the Northwest. Every weekend we practice, you know, it was a practice or demonstration or something at, it was always this at like a sporting goods store or shopping mall or something. So, and that's just where we played. We never just went to a park to play. We always went to, you know, promote the game in front of people. And that was, yeah, for me, it was just kind of like, all right, well, what, you know, where are we going? And they'd pick me up and take me wherever we were going. And that summer in 1981, I went to Alaska a couple of times. And I went to some big sporting goods trade shows. I got in Chicago and did like halftime shows with like the Portland Trailblazers and Seattle Supersonics. And,
nice.
Stuff like that, you know, and that just kind of went wherever they had set something up, and then let's see, so that's so set the first world record at that officially in 1980 at the national championships, and that was I think I did 4,096 I think was that record that I held, and by that time I'd gotten serious about playing net, and I finished third at that tournament in singles, and anyway, that was, you know, then I was pretty much firmly in the grip of obsession with being great at footbag.
And in with the kind of the big names, you know, it's like you were definitely right place at the right time. You found all the right people.
Exactly. Yeah.
12-year-old that there ever was. You're like a prodigy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was, you know, and even to this day, there hasn't really been a kid that young as I was that the closest thing I think since then has been Vashek.
Yeah.
And, he was young, and you know, when he, well, I first met him when I think was at Worlds in San Francisco, and what year was that? Maybe 2001, maybe. And he won that year. I think he was 15 that year, and that was as close. You know, most people throughout the, like, oh gosh, how long have I been doing this? 30 plus years now. And most everybody gets into it like in high school or college. And there aren't, you know, despite, I don't know, you know, there's been a lot of school promotion in school and stuff, but there hasn't been a lot of that, you know, child prodigy kind of thing come along.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. But
I remember when I would go to like kind of hacky sack stuff in school, it started for us in middle school, but we never had anybody come around and like do a presentation or anything like that. But for some reason, the hacky sack just was like an institution in our school.
Uh-huh.
And you know, like we got to middle school and kids were playing hacky sack. And then by the time we were leaving middle school, we were teaching the next kids to play hacky sack. And it just seemed like when you went to middle school, you played hacky sack. And then when you went to high school, some kids continued to play hacky sack, but most of the kids quit. Mm-hmm. But then you had like the kids who picked it up in high school, and then it was, I don't know, it was weird. Like, I had kind of a back and forth with it where I played in middle school, and then I didn't play for a while in junior high, and then I played again in high school, and
right.
Like, I don't know how it got to my school. I don't know when that happened or who brought it there, but it just, I showed up one day and everybody was playing with the hacky sack.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of similar. My school's like that. We played at lunch and in high school. Same thing at grade school. We didn't have middle school when I was coming up. We had K through eight grade schools and then straight to high school. And it was, you know, it was kind of the thing. And then when I went to college and, so I was a freshman at University of Texas at Austin in fall of 1984. And there were, you know, there were people playing in the center of campus. There's these flagpoles right, you know, kind of right in the middle of campus. And every 15 minutes, about 10,000 students walk past this area by these big flagpoles. They're surrounded by grass. And that's where we played. Kick there every day, so I played a lot my freshman year in college, and that was an important year from in terms of freestyle. The evolution of freestyle for PEG was I've advanced a lot that year because I was playing a lot, but then two, I was playing a lot of freestyle frisbee too with some of the best freestyle frisbee players in the world that were also in Austin. And this guy Bob Coleman was telling me about this concept that they had in freestyle frisbee called the which at that time in frisbee meant, you know, kind of delaying the disc, you know, spinning on your fingernail without having done something in front of that, like leg over behind the back or, you know, something like that. So without restricting it somewhat. And so I thought, well, I, you know, in footbag, we could call basic kicks thes. And then if we were to not do any thes, and we'd have to do tricks, 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 trick. And that had never been done before.
Essentially like the blueprint for freestyle footbag as we know it today.
Yeah, it was the key to the change in, you know, and I don't know if I should be credited or blamed, I guess. Because
a lot of people's knees and ankles are really blaming you hard.
and there was a whole sort of, you know, there were people that liked a whole, you know, I enjoyed the kind of that in, you know, the individual aspect of the game, just, you know, trying new things and new hard tricks that I'd never done before and all that kind of. And there was though a lot of, you know, a lot of people at that time that were into kind of a different style of freestyle footbag, you know, playing in a circle, and it's kind of like the circle was the thing, and you had, there was kind of a cultural, you know, kind of pressure almost, or like an obligation to the circle that you're not going to drop it, and you're going to, you know, the objective was not to like show off or do individual things. It was to kind of participate in this sort of this circle that was kind of the unit. And so culturally that kind of, you know, that evolution to this idea of doing trick to trick to trick by yourself, this more individual kind of aspect of the game was not widely supported. It was kind of this interesting, you know, it was what I was into, so it was what I wanted to do. It was rewarded in tournaments because I was doing things that nobody else could do, and because in tournament, you know, you were doing, like, for singles freestyle, you were by yourself, you're playing for 2 minutes or whatever, and so that individual attention that I had, you know, put into the game was rewarded. And so I, you know, I won a lot of tournaments, won a lot of the early world championships and freestyle. And, but it was kind of, you know, it took a long time, really. It was probably close to 10 years, really, before there was, you know, kind of a total shift in the way that, maybe even longer than that, honestly, like, to where now it's the really, you know, while people still get together in circles to play freestyle, there's no passing ever happens anymore. And, you know, it's like, and it's kind of, it's weird to see. It sort of makes sense, I guess, but, you know, it's, you know, there were some sort of fundamental laws of footbag when I played that you know, you could see even as the game was sort of shifting in its evolution towards this more individual style, there were these laws that, you know, you never served yourself and you did always try to finish with a pass. You might drop, but you try, you know, ideally you'd kind of do a cool run and then you'd pass and the next person again. And today that's not the way it works. It's, you know, it's self-serving is pretty much the standard and you go till you drop and then you throw it to the next guy. You know, and it's funny, I watch these kids now, they're very, very good players, but they'll receive a hand toss by catching it in their hand.
Yeah.
And then put it on their foot. I'm like, what in the world? What?
I think that depends on where you're at, too, and who you're particularly playing with, and sometimes, very often, how old they are.
Yeah,
because
right.
I find the longer you've been playing, like a lot of college kids, They know the ropes, you know. They know when you circle up that you're going to get hit by a footbag, potentially by somebody if you self-serve yourself or, you know, stuff. And they pass and whatnot.
Sure,
but then,
sure. Yeah, if you're outside the tournament scene.
Like freestyle.
Yeah.
The kids who don't circle up, you know, or maybe they circle up, like you said, to play freestyle. I've never actually seen that, but I don't know anybody who plays freestyle that much. I'm like the only person in my social group who does it. So I'm at a loss.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Well, it's kind of like in the the tournament scene, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's kind of departed from the sort of the common the masses of footbag. Still, I think, still hold some of those sort of fundamental laws, as truths. And I think, I don't know. I think that in I don't know that I care one way or the other, but it's like when I play, I never serve myself, and you know, it's been a while since I played any freestyle, but it does still kind of almost turn my stomach to see kids, you know, these kids are great players, best in the world, you know, serving themselves and violating rule number one of footbag, you know. But,
yeah,
it's like, you don't serve yourself, anyway, that's kind of a cool get back in that that was kind of the first year, I guess, of the birth of modern footbag freestyle. It was kind of born out of that, some of those ideas that were stolen essentially from freestyle frisbee, and even some of the, you know, some of the first moves. The
first delays.
Delays had been around before that, but some tricks like OSIS is a trick taken,
right.
You know, its name comes directly from Frisbee, and it was, you know, essentially kind of, you know, the concept of it was borrowed directly from Freestyle Frisbee. So
interesting.
So some,
when you say Freestyle Frisbee, I've never heard that before. What does that refer to?
So the, there's competitions. It goes back even longer than footbag, probably to, you know, early 70s, mid 70s or so. So they do competitions with either pairs or trios. And, the people that are really good, what you see them do is throw the disc to, you know, to their partner with a tremendous amount of spin on the disc. And then they'll do what they call a nail delay, where they essentially are spinning the disc on their fingernail, and then, you know, the fingernail's in the middle of the disc, and then do all kinds of crazy maneuvers, tricks and stuff with the disc spinning, as they kind of pass it under their legs, behind their back, spinning and catching and, you know, all that kind of kind of cool stuff.
And do they re-throw it? Or
yeah.
Do they use
no, they'll you know, it'll do a series of tricks and then a catch and then throw it to the, you know, throw it back to the partner again with a, you know, a huge amount of spin, which enables you to do all kinds of cool tricks and stuff. So, yeah, it's quite cool and very similar in feel to, you know, freestyle footbag. So, yeah, check it out. It's a kind of a cool, you know, also sort of underground kind of sport with, you know, a small community of ardent enthusiasts and, you know, not much attention from media or sponsors, that kind of thing. So it's kind of similar in that way.
Interesting. So how old were you when you were first getting into freestyle footbag?
So the first, you know, when I was first starting, they're really... there almost were no tricks at all. The first time I saw a trick, I guess, was, you know, maybe a flying clipper existed when I first went, when I went to that first tournament in 1979.
The move with no delay, right?
Right, just a flying clipper.
Just a jump kick.
Yeah, flying clipper. And then I saw a guy named Craig Hufford do a stall. And it was kind of cool because it was at that time you'd like, you know, he'd kick it way up near like 20 feet or something. And then he'd do this stall with the inside and that, but that was it. Just, whoosh, just sort of stop it and then, you know, toss it back up in the air. And that was kind of the trick, the stall. And, but Stahlberger, ironically, you know, Stahlberger,
yeah, was his name,
was kind of opposed to, kind of philosophically opposed to, you know, stalls, and like he was really, he'd kind of developed these, you know, the fundamentals, the five basic kicks, and beyond that, you know, he was kind of I don't know kind of opposed to freestyle almost in principle. And
do you think it's because he knew that it was going to be the birth of competition in this sport versus the cooperative aspect that was just so like fun loving
yeah,
about it?
Yeah, I think he was, you know, he was kind of into, he was thinking that this is going to be, yeah, that the net game was going to be the sport, and also that this game had this potential to be a training exercise for other athletes in all sports. And it's, you know, it's absolutely...
It's ironic he saw it as training for a different sport, but not training for its own sport.
Well, yeah, I think that he thought that this, you know, the net game was going to be the, you know, the sport. And he was a tremendous net player. He really, you know, he was amazing how advanced his skills were so early in the game. And it's a shame that his knees kind of gave out on him yeah, it was a shame for me because I didn't get to avenge my loss to him in the finals and singles in 1981, and he retired.
Oh, he went out on top.
Yeah, he won and without ever having lost a match.
Wow, the legend.
Yeah, and he retired from singles net after I lost to him in the finals in 81. And so I never got a chance to get back at him for that. So
what's the age difference between you guys?
Oh gosh, he's let's see. He's more than 20 years, I think. I'm not sure.
And you were what, like 20 or so when he beat you?
I was 15, 14. I was 14, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Just about to be 15. So I was pretty young. You know, that was kind of cool in that tournament. At that time, there was no seeding. So they just drew your name out of a hat. And the first name out of the hat was John Stahlberger. And then there, you know, everybody's like, "Oh shit," you know, who's gonna have to play Johnny? And then the next name out of the hat was me. I'm like,
"Oh no!"
Hey, so
the first game of the day,
first match. So I lost to him in the first round, and then that put me into the losers bracket. So it was a double elimination format tournament, and. Because of that double elimination format, the way it works is from the loser's bracket, if you lose in the first round, you literally have to play twice as many matches, and you can't lose again, obviously, or you're out. But to make it all the way back to the finals, I had to, which I did. I had to play twice as many matches as Johnny did to arrive at the final, and then I lost to him in the final. So I did all that work, and then he beat me in the final. But that was a cool.
Well, that's still the underdog story of the century. I mean, you at least got to battle him twice.
Yeah, you know? It was cool, and it was it was pretty neat. You know, at that really young age, to play in the final, and that was a pretty cool deal for me. And then so let's see, I think it was that same year, 1981, I think is the year I invented the Around the World, and so in terms of as far as a footbag went, nobody had ever done that with a footbag before. So
with a delay or with a kick?
No, with a kick. So there really weren't, the footbags at that time, you either had a tough time stalling them. They were they were not real soft. So that would have been pretty tough. There weren't a lot of stalls yet, and then,
no sand filled bags, I'm guessing.
No, definitely not. Although, well, it's interesting because that summer, 1981, I made my first footbag myself, and I filled it with volcanic ash from Mount St. Helens that blew up in May of 1981? I think it might have been 1981.
Where did you get the ash from? Did you go there?
Oh, it was all over the place here. It was like all over our house.
Oh, wow. So you just scooped it up like snow.
Yeah, I was cleaning that out of the, out of our gutters.
Wow.
So, looking up one, I think it was either, look it up, one that blow. 1980 is when it blew up. I think it was like probably, I don't know, it's possible that that summer, but I think it's probably more like the next year when I made that.
So you probably, what did you do, jar up the ash and
just
have it?
Yeah, I think I just had like jars of it and I made this horrible, it was a horrible. but I think I may have made the first sand-filled footbag. I don't know.
What was the outer cover?
It was like suede leather. It was kind of thick.
What? Yeah. Dude, you're like a pioneer.
Yeah. That was terrible, though. So I made that one, and then I think I made maybe two or three other footbags my whole life. And, I was not a I was not the the stitching innovator, but I did, I made that Asheville footbag. I was kind of, I don't know. I can't say that really influenced anybody, but I did that.
Well, maybe because you influenced enough people and your experiences influenced you.
Right. Yeah. That's true. So then, after the, Jack Schoolcraft was a big influence on me for freestyle in the spring of 1981, there was a tournament in Portland that he came to, and I remember him showing me the flying dragonfly kick and butterfly kick and all flyers and kicking tricks, not delays, and he was doing like double spins, even triple spins at that time, and
like triple around the world.
No, spins, like kick it up, spin three times,
Oh, okay.
That kind of thing. So he was real innovative that way. A friend of mine, Mike Harding, that I played, he was my first doubles net partner. He actually invented the pendulum, and that was right around that same year, like 1981. We were just goofing off, I think, at his house, and he figured out how to do the pendulum.
That's seriously one of the most impressive moves to this day. I mean, you do that thing, and people are just like, whoa.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally a crowd pleaser. I think
that was one of the first moves that I learned, and one of the dudes in my high school knew how to do it, and he knew a couple of other stalls. And when he did that, I was just like, this is the sport that I'm going to play,
nice.
You know?
Yeah. So that was cool. I was there to see the first pendulum, and I did the first Around the World. There's a guy named Will Squire that did the first Clipper Stall that I know of, also right around that same time, like 1983-ish or so, 82, 83. And around that time also, I did the first Double Around the World and did that with also with a kick. So from a kick, Double Around the World to a kick. And then, you know, it wasn't too long after that that the footbag started getting softer, and then we started doing everything from stall to stall and that kind of thing. So.
So around 1983, you're saying?
Yeah, I think that was when we started, doing more with stalls. But that was still before. I remember at the Worlds that summer in Boulder, 1984. I remember coming out there, and I was doing like around the world, from toe stalls. Consecutive around the world, and that was a big deal. Like, people were just not doing consecutive tricks. You do consecutive, like, flying clippers. That was something people did back and forth, right. Flying clippers, but to do like consecutive, that would do like around the world, and then double around the world, and that was like a, that was kind of the top of the game at that time, but there hadn't been yet. So that was right before I went down to UT at Austin and came up with that idea to just eliminate basic kicks from freestyle, and that just pushed the skill level so high so fast, because if you have to do another trick, then the vocabulary of tricks you have to have in order to do that, in order to keep going trick to trick, just it had to grow really fast,
right.
and so that led to just a kind of an explosion of innovation and the vocabulary of the basic of all the basic tricks and leg overs, mirages, and osis, and butterfly stalls, and refractions, and stuff like that. Double leg overs and double around the worlds, and all of those kind of things all came out of in proficiency with all of those things. And long strings was kind of what really kind of exploded that year for me. So I was. I remember going to tournaments that next year, '85, and I had just established a really kind of big gap between me and everybody else at that time, because of that year that I had in Austin doing that.
So when you went to tournament, like 1984, 1983. What were the events like? I'm guessing you had net.
Yeah.
Probably big, but then just, was it like, who can get the most kicks?
Well, it's by the time you got to, at Worlds in 1982, I set the consecutive kick world record with almost 14,000 kicks. And that took over 2 hours to do that. And then, that was the last time I ever did consecutive kicks for marathon kind of things.
You did all there is to do.
Yeah, it was just so boring, and it just took it out of you for doing anything else. And the sport was, moving towards net and freestyle, and that was where my interests were. So I didn't compete in the consecutive kick stuff anymore after that. It stuck around as an event at Worlds for a while. And I think I did, if you had to do it to, as part of the overall title, then I would do it. And so whatever events counted towards the overall title, I'd always enter all of those. Cause in the 80s, pretty much through all of the 80s, that was kind of the most prestigious thing at the World Championships was the overall title. And, And then back in that time, everybody did every event. Everybody did the net, freestyle, golf, consecutive kicks, and everybody did all of them. And it was kind of, you know, the overall title was the most important thing, and the most prestigious, event or title basically. And that was what I, went to Worlds every year with the goal to be the overall champion.
So with the freestyle event, I'm sure it didn't look anything like what it looks like today. Did people just do a couple of moves in a row? Like you said, you did your around the world three times and then the double. Like, was that your routine?
Yeah, you'd have still, it was, and time-wise, it was still the same kind of thing. You'd play for 2 minutes and there'd be, a lot more kicks and a lot less tricks. and different sorts of, a lot lower level of difficulty than what you see, what you see now.
I just can't even fathom doing kicks during a freestyle routine.
Right.
Like, I keep asking the same question over and over, I think, because I'm like, what?
Right.
What? That's what they did? That's all they did,
Yeah. Well, there's, I think I put on the Tricks of the Trade 2 DVD, I think that there's some old, routines on that disc. One in particular that's almost entirely kicks and almost no stalls is by a guy named Gary Loud. And Gary was one of the kind of pioneer great freestylers, but in a style that you wouldn't be familiar with. That doesn't resemble anything like what the top freestyle players do today, almost entirely kicking kind of stuff. And so you should check that out. That's kind of
on Tricks 2?
Yeah, it's on Tricks 2, and it's Gary. I can't remember where it is in the disc, but Gary Lout's, one of Gary Lout's routines from, there's a little, actually, I think it's in the, it's in the, towards the beginning, and there's just a kind of a shout out to Gary Lout, and it shows some of his stuff. There's also some stuff from Jack Schoolcraft as well. It's in there, and his his style is also in those early days was almost all kicking oriented kind of tricks, and really really cool style. And so anyway, there's some old style footage in there that kind of captures some of what the freestyle was like in the 80s is on that disc.
I was watching a little piece of Tricks 1. I've been watching Tricks 1 and 2 in, sequential order, so I haven't seen any of Tricks 2, and I've only seen Tricks 1 through what I've posted on YouTube.
Okay.
On the World Wide YouTube channel. So it's I'm catching it little by little.
Right.
But one of the dudes in one of the earlier videos on Tricks 1 does this crazy move that I've literally never, ever seen. He does, a double around the world, but he catches it in an outside stall at the end of it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, and that was probably, that might have been Andy Linder, I would think, possibly.
How come nobody does that anymore?
Yeah, it's cool. Well, yeah, it's a cool trick. It's kind of like it's kind of the predecessor, I guess, to the Whirr. And, cause it's the same kind of movement where you're going, kind of sideways, with the double stuff. I think, there's a lot of cool things that could come back, and be, kind of new again that have been sitting in the closet for a long time.
Right. Like bell bottoms.
Yeah, exactly. I think some of these guys could do some cool stuff from some of the concept, because I remember back in the 80s, I remember distinctly having the thought in the mid 80s that all of the tricks that were ever going to be done with one bag had been done, and that the evolution of freestyle was going to be with two bags, and the juggle kind of tricks, and that, because I just couldn't imagine what else you could do with one. I've never been more, wrong about, that was, right. that was, uh, uh, that was proven to be an idiotic, thought, but it was, yeah, I remember thinking.
Hi, Bashi.
Oh, yeah, I mean, just everybody, you know, even myself, like how much stuff I did just since then, you know, I remember, because, geez, I mean, we had barely even scratched the surface at that, you know, when I was first having that thought, but I don't know what kind of, you know, you go, when you don't, it's easy to learn freestyle for, it's never easy for anybody, but it's easier when it's paved road in front of you, when you can watch perfect form and perfect efficiency of how to execute a trick, and you watch somebody do that and watch it on the internet or watch it, you know, wherever, it's just a million times easier than, you know, the situation for me was, I never had that. And, you know, always for as long as I played, I was always, you know, having to come up with stuff. And that for me was cool. I enjoyed that, you know, coming up. That was what was fun for me is being the first to do something big and huge and inventing the, you know, the next, you know, big tricks and stuff like that. That was always, I always kind of wanted, I don't know, it's like being the first to climb Everest or something, or reach the South Pole and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, there'll never be, you know, no one else will be the first to hit Whirring Swirl. You know, no one else will be the first to hit Blurry Whirling Swirl. No, you know, nobody else will be the first to do it around the world. So, you know, it's those kind of things.
Those tricks, were you like... Like, sometimes I think about footbag a lot in my head, and it's like a video, and I'll imagine tricks I'm going to do, but it's really, like, that video can play in my head because I've seen video of those tricks being done, you know. But and was that what it was like for you? Like, would you imagine, like, this is what I'm going to do, and then try to get your body to do that?
Yeah, it was. Like, I remember driving back down to school in Eugene, college. I was driving from Portland. I was just, you know, listening to radio or music or something, and I would always freestyle in my head. And that was the first time I did a whirling swirl, was just in my head. I imagined it, and I was like, whoa, I gotta try that trick, 'cause I'd never done that before. And I as soon as I got down to Eugene, I tried that trick and I hit it, and I, wow, this is an awesome, this is a game changer trick. So, but that, yeah, I'd see it in my head. Yeah, you know, imagine.
That's so cool.
Yeah. That's pretty fun. That was pretty cool, you know.
Well, you're spot on when you say it's a lot easier for, you know, my generation, and there's probably, some generations, you know, after me and in between us that just had it a lot easier, but mine was, I feel like we got it particularly easy because it was like probably 1999, 2000 mm-hmm. when I started getting into footbag, and that's really when like YouTube came out, the internet. You didn't have like, let's just go watch a video of whatever I want right now.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. There was hardly any, you know, it's funny because now everybody's got a cell phone with a video camera in it, and, you know, it's so easy to take a photo or a video of something. But back in the 80s, like, we just didn't have, you know, nobody had video cameras. They're just, you know.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of footage around.
Well, even if you did, you had to take the tape over to your buddy's house and play it. And, you know, like, you had to have a lot of machinery to make it happen, and you had to be physically present with the person going with you.
Yeah, so it didn't, we didn't have the convenience of being able to kind of spread the word that way. So there was a real tight-knit kind of small community of us that, you know, that were, into this, you know, freestyle in the early days, and we'd, you know, get together over a weekend at an event, you know, kind of exchange knowledge basically. And,
so that's how you guys would trade information, basically, like at events and stuff.
Yeah, at tournaments, essentially. Yeah.
So you guys didn't have that mentality back then. This is just kind of my mind going here, but like today, if I do a new trick, like I learned how to juggle four balls, or I did a double around the world for the first time the other day, and I was like, oh, I gotta make a video of this and put it on YouTube. Did you have that urge to be like, I just invented something nobody's ever done, I need to get this out to the community so they can know it?
Right. Well, it was delayed. I get, you know, I definitely was, you know, if I invented something and I wanted to show it off, it'd be, I'd wait, you know, I'd have to basically wait for the next event. I wouldn't videotape anything. I didn't have any means of videotaping anything, but I would definitely be looking forward to the next tournament to show off the latest innovations. Yeah.
Well, and probably win with it too, I would imagine.
Yeah, I did a lot of won a lot of events back in those days. It was always hard to at Worlds because I was always, you know, my first priority was the overall, and I always went to Worlds with the goal to win every event I was entered in, and I never accomplished that. But the closest I got was in 1989 and 1990. And in both of those years, I won singles freestyle and singles net in the same year. And that, I don't know that that'll be done again. That'd be surprising to me if somebody does that again.
I was talking to Bruce about that particular conundrum of, like, there's not a lot of people who just do both of those things. You either do one or the other, and there seems to be kind of a migration from one to the other.
There has been, you know, it's generally been a migration from freestyle to net as, right. You know, it's like when you're young, you're a freestyler, and when you get, you know, when you get a little older, you play net. The closest thing today to, you know, someone that could conceivably, that has the skills in both disciplines to even possibly consider, you know, the chance to win both events in the same year would be Kareem Daouk, who won singles net this last year. And he was a, you know, top shelf, you know, world class freestyler, before he switched over to net a few years ago. And it's conceivable that he, you know, if he was to keep playing freestyle, that he could do that. But otherwise, there's none of the top net players. There aren't that many of the crossovers that have become, you know, really elite net players. There's a few. Tuan Vuz is, you know, quite a good net player and was a, you know, was a top freestyler. Eric Wolf was a, you know, former world champion in singles net and became an elite net player. But that, you know, that's a pretty short list. So yeah, that's probably, you know, for me to, that's something I'm proud of, is having been, you know, towards the, you know, the top of the game in both of the main disciplines.
Has anybody done that since?
No, nobody ever did it before, and nobody's done it since. So.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool.
So what year did you record Tricks of the Trade?
That was 1991.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's when we did that. And that was Bruce's idea. It wasn't really something that I was thinking about. And Bruce had the idea to do it. And
were you still competing at that time?
Was I? Yeah. That was in the, you know, in the prime of my, you know, competition year. So we did it right before Worlds that year in 91. And I flew out to Colorado. We went into a studio I think, you know, Bruce had the idea. So when we came out to the studio, I had written up the script. I had, let's see. We did it in two different sessions. So first we recorded all the footage, and I don't think I had to do much preparation for that, other than just, you know, show up and then do all the, you know, just basically just go through that catalog. I think there's 41 tricks in there. They go from, you know, kind of the simple one ad tricks up to 2, 3, 4 ad. They cap out at 4 ads, I think. But there's a bunch of cool 4 ad tricks on there. And so just, you know, kind of went through, recorded those from all those different camera angles. And then I took the raw footage, and then I edited just on a system at home with two VCRs, I made a rough edit of the video and recorded basically like all the timestamps for the cuts for the edits and then recorded wrote the script for the voiceover for explaining all the tricks, and then went back out to Colorado to go into the studio with essentially an editing technician on the controls with the master footage and gave him essentially all of my notes about all the timestamps for all the edit, every cut. And God, there's a million of them in there. So that took, three or four days or something to doing that. So that was pretty cool. Back then it wasn't, that was kind of how you had to do something like that versus, there wasn't the same kind of do-it-yourselfer environment that we have now. But that was hugely successful. I don't know. Bruce could probably tell you how many Tricks of the Trade videos have been sold over its 30 years or so history. 20 years, I guess. 20 years. But it was a lot back in those days before. That was even before DVDs.
Right.
And then certainly before the internet. And 10 years later, we did Tricks 2. In 2001, and that was, I wasn't competing anymore in freestyle by that time, but I was still playing, but also brought in a whole kind of cast of characters to some of the top players in the game at the time to basically do the tricks. So there's the same kind of thing. It's a nice catalog. It's some really big stuff that's on that second one. But by that time, Tricks 2 was not anywhere near as successful because, we were doing that right at the dawn of the internet. And so it, the internet had come in and, internet killed the video.
Yeah,
basically. So
there needs to be a parody of that song that sings that tune, because it's like it just needs to happen.
Yeah, it was, it was exactly that, and you could just see it happen. So we actually put quite a lot more into Tricks 2, it's a lot higher level. The tricks and stuff like that I thought it was kind of a shame it didn't do better, but it was also happening when it was easier for people to make their own videos. There's a lot more competition for footbag videos by the time Tricks 2 came out, but there's a bunch of cool historical stuff on Tricks 2 that Tricks 1 doesn't have,
Tricks 1 is kind of sparse for that. There's like there's an old commercial and
right.
A little bit of other stuff, but it's really all about the tricks.
Yeah, pretty much. So Tricks 2's got a lot more sort of color with the historical stuff. I wanted to try to capture some of that history so that it would be recorded somewhere and people would have access to it. Some of the who's gonna ever hear about Gary Lout or Jack Schoolcraft or Jan Lind, Dennis Ross, Sam Conlon, those people that we just don't have. I know that it's not like watching an NBA game or NFL game or something on TV and the commentators all sort of refer to the legends of the game and this.
And they know, like, every stat.
Yeah, all that stuff. It adds a lot of, I think it adds a lot of, interest to the broadcast. But back then, there's no broadcast. So
we should have that.
Nobody could do that, so.
It could be you and, Bruce.
Yeah.
And maybe a couple other dudes who, are really good with names and numbers and just be like, oh, yeah, here comes
Yeah.
You know, Tuan's been around since this long, and
just to give some of that historical reference, like, oh, nobody's done that since, you know, whatever. I think that'd be cool. So
that's like ideal century for like the IFPA world.
Right.
That would be awesome. And plus, I think Worlds really needs some kind of a video feed for people like me who are like not going to make it, but we're really interested and we just want to tune in.
Right.
That would be a very entertaining way to stay on the feed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like a Ustream or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Ustream is the bomb. I'm actually surprised they haven't gotten so much bigger.
Yeah. I've watched some, I don't travel to too many Frisbee tournaments, but I follow as a fan and I'll log into the live streams when they do that, that kind of thing. So I can, you know, cause they're not on TV either, you know, same kind of thing as Footbag. So
I discovered it when I was watching, Occupy Oakland. I would be sitting in my home in Oakland watching the protesters outside. So I wouldn't have to go outside and risk getting hurt, but I did want to see what was going on, and there would be a lot of people on Ustream just walking around in the crowd with their phones, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, very, very good technology there.
Nice. Well, what else can I tell you about it?
I've been writing myself down questions here as I think of them, and I just ran out, so
all right.
I'm thinking I gotta have one more good question about tricks. Tricks one. What do you think of tricks one in a modern context?
You know, I think that it's, you know, I don't even know, you know, like I've got two kids now, 12-year-old and a 16-year-old, and these guys, you know, it's almost like the DVD is just like a relic. You know,
the format itself.
Yeah, I think that what you're doing with, you know, transferring this in pieces to YouTube is a way for this, you know, for this thing to kind of, you know, continue to have relevance. By virtue of the format, because my kids they watch YouTube like crazy, but they just, you know, they have access to DVD players, but they don't use them. And
it's too much time.
Yeah, they're just, you know, they're on the internet. So I think that, you know, certainly all of those, you know, like if you've mastered every trick that's on Tricks of Trade, then you are a high level freestyler. Right?
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment.
You're top 1%, you know, or less, you know,
yeah.
That like,
yeah.
Like,
I've done like maybe half the tricks on there and I'm really working hard on the rest of them. And I've only like I told you, I've only seen the ones that I've posted so far. So they just get harder. And I'm like,
right.
I'm pretty sure from here on out, I don't know any of these, but I keep surprising myself.
Cool.
I'll see stuff that I don't know the name for. And I'm like, hey, I could do that trick.
That's funny. You know, there are some tricks in there that as you get towards the, you know, towards the higher ones where there are more efficient ways of doing a lot of those tricks. What you'll see towards the end.
And the way you did it,
yeah,
in the DVD.
Yeah. Cause there are that. And in that day, like there's a trick on there called Blur that, you know, the way it's done on that videotape is, you know, what's referred to these days as downtime versus uptime. And when you do it in the uptime method, you make it about twice as easy. And
right.
Cause your first, the first dexterity is done while the bag's still going up. Yeah.
Right.
On that video, you'll see it that the entire move is done with the bag going down. And it's way harder, and you know, but it's like we didn't at that time, we hadn't thought of the idea of doing, you know, tricks with an uptime set, and so that was an innovation that came later and made a lot of those things easier. At that, you know, so there's, it's out of date for some of those tricks, but like if you could do, you know, if you can do blur downtime, then when you learn it, you know, when you see it done I'm sure, you know, most of the players now learn it the efficient way because they see it on YouTube or something. And that's, so, you know, I mean, it almost loses something on, because, if you do it downtime, it's just twice as hard. It's more impressive kind of thing. But
it's, yeah, it looks way faster because you're really,
it's like, way, you know, anyway, all the tricks are, you know, that involve that, because that particular, you know, set innovation kind of came later, that, you know, that video is a little, you know, those tricks anyway are a little bit dated, I guess, because of that. So, but
was that your innovation?
The uptime, you know, I don't remember. It was kind of like something that just sort of wove into things. There was,
like, it just clicked one day, or somebody showed it to you.
Yeah, I can't remember. There was, I think that it came, and I don't think I can take credit for it, although I certainly, you know, learned it and used it a lot on, especially as we got, you know, into stuff like Blurry Whirl and Stepping Whirl and
Were you, just a quick question, were you doing Double Around the World on downtime?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Jesus, man. Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah, like off a kick. So it had to be downtime. Yeah, downtime Double Around the World was the first Double Around the World there was. Because doing it off a kick. So that.
The only thing that helped me learn that move was literally the realization of uptime and like the little tiny pocket that I needed to create between like the bottom of my knee and the back.
Right,
like it,
right.
It just passed right over the top to give me that sweet spot.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that I can't even imagine doing it with, like, that was literally my breakthrough. I was like, oh yeah, I do uptime. I've never used that term before, so I'm going to use it now. I like it.
Yeah.
But I would do uptime for my around the world, and I would teach people that concept, but without good terms. So it's probably confusing for them, but that's perfect. I called downtime the pocket,
uh-huh,
and I never had a word for uptime.
Right.
That's actually like, that's genius.
I don't know if people still use those terms anymore, but for a while that was what, you know, that was kind of how, you know, it was kind of how people talked about it. So that's how I know those terms anyway, being used. And it makes, you know, it just makes sense. It's like, if you're doing the decks when the ball, you know, is on its way up, then you've got time to do whatever when it's on its way back down again. It just makes things way easier. But when we were first conceiving some of these tricks, we just, you know, weren't smart enough yet. It's like some things that are so obvious after the fact.
Hindsight is just 20/20.
Yeah, they were just so hard to conceive of some of these things, beforehand. So, it almost feels kind of stupid, looking back, like, God, how come it took so long to figure that out? But,
well, and it's good to tell these stories too, because, you know, like, you're looking at yourself and saying, wow, I feel pretty stupid. And then there's all these people like me who are the next generation, and we're just like, it's all like taken for granted, you know, like, oh, there's always just been like, of course you would do your around the world.
Right.
Like,
right,
as soon as you release the bag, you wouldn't want to wait. You would have less time. And, you know, it's kind of like second nature for us now, but there has to be that passing of the knowledge so that we can be like, hey, this didn't just happen one day.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
we put a lot of work into making this a concept.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard fought, and there were, God, I mean, it was kind of weird that, you know, it's interesting today because you see how much easier it is today for people to learn, you know, and kind of ramp up to high level in freestyle, whereas back in kind of like the mid to late 80s, it was just so slow how many people could even learn what was already there. And I guess part of that's the lack of having video, and I don't know, it's just maybe some sort of cultural kind of thing. The more people that can do this, the more, you know, I think by the time Vachette comes along and there's an internet to learn from, and he's thinking, as he's watching Ryan Mulroney and Rick Reese and Peter Irish and probably some of me, and thinking, these guys never drop, because he's watching edited footage.
Right.
And so he thinks, well, you don't drop it. That's just how it is. And then, you know, so the kid never dropped it. It's just kind of almost like there's an expectation that you have, like this, oh, this is, you know, that's how it is. So that's how I do it. And just, you know it's possible because you've seen it. And so, your mindset just is different than it was for us back in the 80s when we didn't know what the next thing was supposed to be, what it was going to look like, and, had to kind of go down some wrong turns on some trick concepts that just didn't work out.
Have you seen or read or looked into it all, Vazic and Dan Edney's Bookbag Manual?
No. No, I didn't know that there was such a thing.
Oh, I should send that to you. I don't think Dan would mind. Him and Vazic basically co-wrote it. Dan went and trained with Vazic.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to pronounce his name wrong the whole time because I only saw it on the internet all growing up. So I always say Vazic. And apparently it's Vazic.
Vazic?
Yeah, Vazic. So sorry, Vazic, if you're seeing this. Obviously, he's a prodigy, he's a genius, and to get into his mindset is probably beneficial to anybody who wants to learn, how to play pro footbag. And Dan Edney was gracious enough to work with him and then kind of translate it all into English and write it all down and kind of tell the story of his kind of early childhood and what led to him being a prodigy in the sense of the mentality that comes with. And also how he got into footbag and different things like that. But it's a very, very interesting story. And then the bulk of the manual is actually his training routine, which is absolute insanity. Mm. It's like run 10 miles and then do this kick 1,000 times and then run 5 more miles and then do this kick 1,000 times and never drop it. Yeah. And it's just like, are you serious, dude? But you can tell, that's why he is who he is, because that's how you got to train when you want to get that far.
Yeah.
But do you have any kind of crazy training routines like that? Like, I'm just going to go as hard as I can possibly go every freaking day,
Well, nothing like run 10 miles.
I'll send you the manual. It's ridiculous.
That's awesome. I used to play more than... I suspect that I was playing more than anybody at the time back in the 80s because I had the free time. I didn't have a job. I was in high school and college and had my summers off to just train all day every day. And for like those 8 years, those were kind of my my prime years from 19. And even post college a bit as well, where that was probably, I guess, I stopped. The last year I competed in the overall was 1992, and then I quit doing the overall. So my years were kind of from 80 to 92, and where by the time 1990 summer 1990 is when I got my first full time job. And those married in summer 91, and so the priorities started shifting a bit at that point. And but those for that block of like 12 years, I was all footbag all the time in the summers and trained a lot, did a lot of cross training, did rode my bike everywhere, did a lot of mountain bike riding, and also. I was training in all the events. I was playing net every day and playing freestyle every day.
Do you need a partner to train in net?
Yeah, so Matt Hughes and I was in the earlier days. It was with Mike Harding, who was my buddy from school, and all through high school, I played a lot with Mike, and then I switched partners, played with Mag Hughes toward the latter half of the 80s, and we would play. And Mag, his job involved in school, which he still does today, school shows for juggling, footbag, you know, that kind of thing. And so he would have
hands and feet now?
What's that?
Is he doing hands and feet now?
Yeah. Well, Mag, not like Peter Irish, nothing like that.
I don't know if anybody in the world does it like Peter Irish.
Yeah, no, he would do, either footbag or juggling, not both at the same time for the most part.
Oh, okay, okay.
And doing it, he was a great net player. He was a talented performer and does these school shows that are really cool and still does those now all over the Northwest. And that's his job. So he had summers, more open. And so we played, we trained quite a bit, back in the kind of late 80s for playing net. But I wouldn't do, I don't know that, I did these drills, these patterns, around the world, switch over.
Steps almost.
Yeah, and there's some of them you'll see on, towards it, like at the end of, when you get to the end of Tricks 1, there's a pattern in there that I did as a drill, like a, switch over mirage, stuff like that. So I would school these different patterns basically to, it's kind of training regimen, and did a lot of that playing alone. My biggest interest though is always in learning the, coming up with the next, the next cool big trick, being the first to hit something big.
Right.
That's kind of what I wanted. So I wanted to put my name on some big trick.
Did you put your name on some pretty big tricks?
I did the first whirring swirl. Did the first blurry whirling swirl.
You should have called it the whirring shulk.
Yeah, I didn't ever name anything after myself. double spinning torque, or spinning Mobius, I guess you'd call that. Baroque. I did the first whir, did the first, whirring blender, a lot, I guess. I was the first to do a lot of cool stuff, big stuff.
Well, speaking of the naming on some of these, something that's interesting to me, I got a YouTube comment on one of the videos the other day, and some young pup was telling me that, this is funny, but he was telling that this isn't the name of the move. It's got this name now. And I was like, wow, how interesting, because like, I don't know a lot of the names anyway, because I never got into the names that much. It wasn't like interesting to me. I would be in my head all the time and thinking, let me move my leg this way, and then I'll do this move right here, and I won't call it anything because it's just me playing by myself in my yard or whatever.
Right.
But apparently names have changed over the years.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get too caught up in the name. I was more.
Yeah.
There's a few. One of the some of the big tricks that maybe I'm famous for, I guess, like the Big Apple and Big Apple Sauce. Those are two kind of big, huge tricks that have kind of cool names. The Big Apple was named Big Apple because it was invented in 1992 in Central Park in New York. And
very appropriate.
And then, I think that the next year or something is when it was at a Michigan Christmas jam and out in Michigan with the guys out there, and we were having breakfast before we were going to play at this hotel, and I thought of the idea of the Big Apple Sauce, but basically kind of adding this adding an element into that trick that's a kind of big, huge, dynamic trick anyway.
Is that trick on Tricks or Tricks 2?
No, the close cousin to the Big Apple Sauce is actually Big Apple is on there. Pete does it on Tricks 2, and there's a trick called Anonymous on on Tricks 2 that is very similar to the sauce, but it's a bailout going for the Big Apple sauce. If you don't quite get one element completed, then there's a bailout option for Anonymous, and you still ended up with a 6-out trick. So it's nice to have that option. So if you don't have quite enough time to get back underneath the ball, so that's kind of.
I'm going to be on the lookout for that now, yeah. The Big Apple.
Yeah.
Anonymous.
So those are cool. Those are cool tricks. Some of the bigger things that I can put.
I think the one that came up that it had the name changed, I'm not positive about this because I don't quite remember, but I think it was the Pixie, and it was either called something before and now it's Pixie, or that's changed since it was Pixie or something like that.
So, I mean, Pixie is, I don't know if it's called something else now, but, it's just an upside, inside out around the world set. And then, it's not really a trick as so much as it's a set, basically. And it's an uptime inside out around the world set. And Fairy was the same thing, but, outside in. So you go outside in on the around the world. It's also an uptime set. So those are kind of those two variants of the same side, so you're doing the dexterity with the same leg that you're doing the set with, and then there's atomic and nuclear that are kind of similar sorts of variants. I can't remember the name. Quantum. So there's quantum and atomic and then nuclear and. There's probably the crossbody equivalent to quantum that I don't remember the name of, but somebody's probably done and knows what that is. But anyway, there's a bunch of cool, but what's cool about all of those things is once you have established that set element, then you can incorporate that into just about every trick. So it's like, oh, I'm going to do a nuclear torque or a nuclear whirling swirl. So you just like do the nuclear set and then do something after it. And then,
right.
Just by creating that one element, you've expanded the vocabulary of tricks by, kind of exponentially. So that's what are some of the other cool sets? There's the one that Eric was doing, Eric Wolf was doing, that I can't remember the name of, but it, the trick that he did with it, it called Timber Wolf, and that was cool because his last name's Wolf, so
nice.
So that was I can't remember what that set was called exactly, but anyway, so you've got stepping and blazing and nuclear and quantum and fairy and pixie and blazing. Blazing is a cool one where you're basically uptime whirling. So that's pretty cool trick.
I like how the tricks have sort of become like what's the word? Like adjectives almost, right. Because they're meant to be paired with something else.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a cool aspect of the new game.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's easier, I guess, to remember, sort of the names of elements and rather than, so I was like, okay, well, whirling swirl, that's a, you know what that is because if you know what a whirl is and a swirl is, then you know what a whirling swirl is and rather than calling it something, like tomato sauce or something,
yeah.
So, which doesn't tell you anything about what it is. So I was always more inclined to just name things based on what their elements were rather than give them some sort of, until the name got so big that you couldn't do it anymore. And then it's simpler to say, well, it's this, because to name it by its elements would be you know, a whole sentence. And that,
right.
You know, kind of ridiculous. But.
Well, Ken, I think we covered a lot of ground here today. I'm getting pretty hungry.
Yeah, sounds good, Jono. And, you know, happy to lay down some of the historical memories. So
laying out the facts for us.
Thanks for your efforts to bring some of this to the next generation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, exactly. I just know that my experience growing up was like, I could have really used this information. And some of the people who should be my heroes that are now my heroes, like you and Bruce and people, were kind of second, you know, were kind of bypassed by the more recent elements like Bajic, who just worked there on YouTube. It's like that simple. You know, Bajic didn't invent footbag. He just is a really good footbag player. So there needs to be a lot of names that just kind of get out there and a lot of information that I think needs to stop being skipped over and get out there, like John's book,
right?
You know,
right.
I really wish that would happen.
Yeah, I hope that he you know, can stick with that. That's a mountainous undertaking, yeah. To, you know, but it is the kind of thing that probably, you know, probably really ought to be, you know, Johnny's story, and he's the guy to tell, especially those, you know, those first few years, and that part of the history is one that, you know, nobody else can really do justice to. And
yeah.
So I hope he's able to, you know, see that happen. It'd be cool.
I hope so too. I have a feed that I check every day. It's just on Twitter and whatnot. Just anybody who tweets Hacky Sack or anybody who tweets Footbag, you know, I see it. So I try to interact with people on that. And I can't tell you how many times I see, you know, from these like fact accounts, you know, they're like fun facts or trivia or whatever, and they say Footbag was, or Hacky Sack was invented in Turkey, and it's just like, man, you could not be more wrong about that. Like,
that's funny.
Or in China, I hear that a lot more too. Yeah. Or Turkey, I hear it recently, but China more historically, I've heard that more often. But
I imagine that there were people kicking objects, you know, in various places.
Exactly.
That this modern footbag that we play definitely had its, you know, had its origins, you know, right here in Oregon, and
very clearly traced.
It's no mystery about it.
A lot of witnesses.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly there were other people, you know, other games like it around the world for millennia, but this one, this particular angle on it started here, you know, pretty definite date. So. Cool.
All right. Well, we got one leg of the journey down here. Hopefully my recorder recorded. It says it is, at least. So.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we got to do it, and great to meet you by Skype, Jono, and have a great Thanksgiving, and hopefully we'll cross paths someday.
Exactly. You too, Ken.
All right.
Great to meet you.
Yeah. Thanks.
See you, man.